give you get you a final comment.
The conflict between Trump and the intelligence and the deep state is a spat, not a struggle. Trump has insulted them. He has disrespected them. So they're unhappy with that. More importantly, Trump wants them to change their tactics, to become more crude and even more violent. Once they work together on a couple of new wars, they'll get along just fine.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you for joining us, Alan Aaron and Julian. In our last 10 seconds, you're coming up on 5 years in the embassy. How are you doing in the Ecuadorian embassy in London?
Well, last year, I won an epic victory against the UK government and the Swedish government at the UN. Formal ruling. It's repeated in November. Those governments still have to obey the UN. I'm being illegally detained. And I should be freed and compensated. That's according to the UN.
Julian Assange, founder and editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy birthday to David Prude. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Malkoff, Johnny Hamilton, Ravi Karen. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, this is LeVar Howard over here at OSP. And I'm a part of the Yuhuru Salsa Cultural Club. And I just want to remind everybody, check us out, April 10th, Prison Pipeline.
Hey, this is Harold. We held our annual talent show here at OSP. What you're going to hear is you're going to hear an eclectic sound of music. You're going to hear some acoustic. You're going to hear some rap. You're going to hear some fun times. You're going to hear some people do some things close to their heart. And you're going to hear some things to ride to and have a good time to. So it's going to be on Prison Pipeline, April 10th, 6:30 p.m.
Prototype. Prototype, call it the volume one, call it the overnight, call it what you want to call it. I can't call it wrong or right, man. It's song a tightness, a prototype testing, testing 1, 2, 3.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Gospel of Loving Kindness at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center in Portland. The Gospel of Loving Kindness is a play by Marcus Gardley based on the true story of 15-year-old Hadiya Pendleton, who was killed in Chicago after performing at the presidential inauguration in 2013. This play runs from March 10th through April 9th on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. Again, that's The Gospel of Loving Kindness, March 10th through April 9th on Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, 5340 North Interstate in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. This program is made possible by KBOO members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting a candidate forum for Portland Public School District Board candidates on Tuesday, April 11th at 7 p.m., at the Multnomah County Building, 501 Southeast Hawthorne. This forum is in partnership with Oregon Parent Teacher Association and Communities and Parents for Public Schools. More information at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Neil Gorsuch is sworn into the Supreme Court.
Portland commits to renewable energy.
And today is National Sibling Day. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 10th, 2017. I'm Tracy Kiyama.
And I'm Tracy Kiyama's sister, Jenny Yokoyama. What do most Americans have in common? Having a sibling. Today is National Sibling Day. Sibling Day was created in 1995 by Claudia Everett as a way to honor her siblings who had both passed away early in separate accidents. Everett has compared the day to Mother's Day or Father's Day, hoping that people would take the day to spend time with or acknowledge their siblings. According to some studies, having a sibling could be attributed to reduced allergies and a longer lifespan, while another recent study suggests that people without siblings are smarter and more mature. In the 1990s, 80% of Americans reported having at least one sibling. We can expect to see this percentage decline as the millennial generation has the most number of single-child households in a century. Since its creation, National Sibling Day has been formally recognized by 49 different states, as well as by three presidents during their time in the White House. Those presidents were George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama.
That Supreme Court seat that's been sitting vacant has finally been filled. Neil Gorsuch was sworn in as the 113th Supreme Court Justice of the United States today by Chief Justice Roberts at a ceremony at the White House.
I, Neil M. Gorsuch, do solemnly swear.
I, Neil M. Gorsuch, do solemnly swear.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
And do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
And do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
And that I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform.
And that I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform.
All the duties incumbent upon me,
all the duties incumbent upon me,
as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States,
as Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States,
under the Constitution and laws of the United States,
under the Constitution and laws of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations. Thank you.
Antonin Scalia's seat in the court has been vacant for over a year following his death in February 2016. President Obama's pick, Merrick Garland, failed to get confirmation, leaving the seat open for the conservative judge. Gorsuch's confirmation process saw a change in procedure when Republicans changed Senate rules in order to break a Democratic filibuster aimed at blocking the appointment. At the age of 49, Gorsuch is the second youngest nominee to the Supreme Court, with Clarence Thomas being the youngest. Gorsuch has two siblings who both live out of the political limelight.
In an open letter released Friday, the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court urged federal officials to declare courthouses off limits to immigration arrests. Chief Justice Thomas Ballmer wrote that immigration and customs enforcement raids at courthouses creates a chilling effect not only on undocumented residents, but also on legal residents. The Chief Justice wrote that ICE's action also deter appearances in court by legal residents who don't want to be subjected to hostile questioning based on their ethnicity. Ballmer joins U.S. Representatives Susan Bonamici and Earl Blumenauer in a call for courthouses to be deemed sensitive locations where ICE raids would be banned. Currently, schools, churches, hospitals, and funerals are labeled as sensitive locations under federal law. Although two of Oregon's representatives and the Chief Justice of Oregon's Supreme Court are in favor of banning ICE actions at courthouses, the law is unlikely to be passed by the Republican-controlled government in Washington. The White House and current U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions are also on record as being firmly against the ban when they responded critically last month to a similar law proposed by the state of California.
Portland is going renewable. Mayor Ted Wheeler announced that Portland will try to be run by 100% renewable energy by 2050. The transition will be done gradually, with renewable electricity to the community being transitioned by 2035. Despite cutbacks by the Trump administration to federal programs, Portland leaders are promising will continue the fight against climate change. Portland joins a growing list of cities and local municipalities that have committed themselves to 100% renewable energy. Vancouver, BC is our closest neighbor to the north, who has made the commitment to 100% renewables. To the south, San Francisco has committed themselves to transition by the year 2030.
Reese Ehrlich is a best-selling book author and freelance journalist who writes for CBS Radio, Australian Broadcasting Corps, and National Public Radio. His book, Inside Syria, The Backstory of the Civil War and What We Can Expect, focuses on debunking conspiracy theories about the Middle East. KBOO's Chris Andre spoke to him about Syria's formation, the Assad government's popular politics, and the illegality of the Syrian war.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Reese. I'm speaking with Reese Ehrlich, a Peabody Award-winning foreign correspondent. There is a paperback edition of the 2014 book Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. And I don't think it's too much a stretch to say that this is pretty much what the world should have expected. So we thank you again. Many thanks for being with us today. You have a quote here. I see, so while seemingly dealing a decisive blow against Bashar al-Assad's use of poison gas in reality, the attack seriously escalates the war. Well, I want to ask you first up, can you talk a little bit about that, the disconnect, the misunderstanding?
First of all, the attack on Syria is completely illegal. There was no vote in the United Nations, no discussion or vote in Congress. There's no basis in law, internationally or domestically, for an attack of this kind. A convenient issue. Things are so bad they didn't even try to present a legal justification. That's how things have gotten so bad. If I feel like bombing, I'm going to bomb it, and damn the Constitution. Secondly, as a practical matter, even more importantly, it's going to fail. If, as he says, it's just a one-off strike, it's warning Assad not to use chemical weapons again. Well, you know something? Assad says he's never used chemical weapons, including this time. So all he has to do is not use them again, but continue sharp attacks on civilians using conventional weapons, and presumably Trump has just given him a green light. I mean, it's absurd. What's much more likely to happen is that this is simply one step, one additional step in a effort to escalate the war in Syria, to continue attacking and escalating attacks on Iran, and in fact to come in confrontation with Russia. It's a very dangerous situation because while the U.S. considers it to be a limited tactical action, the rest of the world may well interpret it differently. And when you start an act of war, you don't know where it's going to end.
Yeah, this is the troubling thing. It's who says it's decisive? The U.S. thing is decisive is beating us because there's everything else is still on the chessboard. He's just like maybe wiped out.
I mean, what is really going on here is Trump betrayed the people who voted for him because he left the impression that he was not going to get us involved in another Middle East war. He claimed he opposed the war in Iraq, which was a lie. He said he opposed a war in Syria, and then he gets into office and appoints generals to his cabinet, whose first whose knee-jerk reaction to the situation is to wage war. And so I'm just wondering, for those libertarians and conservatives and isolationists who thought they were voting for a different kind of president, this is one more betrayal of what they view, and he's basically become part of the mainstream right-wing, hard right-wing Republican party that advocates military intervention around the world. And it's not going to work. It's going to the next test is going to be when Assad engages in killing of additional civilians using conventional weapons, not chemical weapons. And women and children are killed, and Trump sees this on TV, is going to say, oh my God, babies were killed. I suddenly discovered this, so we have to bomb them again. Very dangerous.
I cannot imagine the back room rationale the suddenness of it Trump is ostensibly talking trade with Xi Jinping, who's running circles around him and, you know, saying yes to all sorts of agreements because they know they have observed in Chinese media said that the purpose of the visit was so that Xi Jinping could assess Trump's weaknesses, his Achilles heel, and use that, and immediately that's what happened. But bombing,
you figured country, out that the entire administration is an Achilles heel.
Yeah, it is. But to launch a missile strike into the world's greatest hotspot while you're supposed to be in trade talks, I can't understand how that could happen. What possible rationale?
Well, I don't think that the Trump administration does not have a coherent foreign policy. It's very reactive, it's very erratic, and it's full of contradictions and debates. So you have Bannon, who kind of represented this right-wing populist mentality that was supposed to put America first. You have the generals and Tillerson, who represent the traditional Republican foreign policy perspective of aggression on oil and pipelines and military bases, and they're fighting among themselves. And Trump really doesn't have any principles to speak of. He certainly doesn't have any ideology other than I'm rich and therefore I'm right. And now we're seeing the results. So what I've noticed is that when he's erratic in his kind of populist way, he's ignored. His policies aren't carried. When he's erratic in his hardline Republican interventionists and tax the poor and give up the taxes on the rich, then that those policies are adopted. So I think what's happening is the mainstream, main right-wing stream of the Republican Party is sucking him gradually into their way of thinking, and that's the policies we're seeing.
And how, though, I have to ask this, is there a way of backing out? There's no way to back out of this. Is there any, what possible gambit is available now this has happened?
First of all, I wouldn't even look at it that way. I'd look at it as that there's got to be a grassroots movement which is going to force him to change. You can't rely on Trump or his cabinet to come up with some kind of rational, logical position.
But it would be enlightened self-interest to see
I could see, for example, we saw, it wasn't that long ago, it's not ancient history, that millions of people marched in the streets all over the country, including Eugene, protesting Obama on the women's called march. Then millions more showed up at airports to protest the ban on Muslims coming from other countries. And I think a similar kind of movement can put a tremendous amount of pressure on Trump to stop the wars in Iraq and Syria. And under that kind of pressure, sure, he could suddenly decide, go back to what he claimed it was his policy, was not to get involved, and to say, well, that was just a one-time thing, and we're going to de-escalate in Syria. Left to his own devices, that won't happen. It has to come from pressure from below.
But can he de-escalate it?
The U.S. can always de-escalate. In the Vietnam War, the same question was asked. How can you pull the troops out when our fighting the communists in Vietnam, so we don't have to fight them over here? Well, how do you pull them out? On ships and planes, just like they got over there. Well, that's exactly how you get the troops out of Syria and Iraq. It's just not considered a viable option by Washington, where the debate is between some intervention and lots of intervention.
It would seem, too, that this time around, that the resistance, the protest, would probably draw many of Trump's original supporters who are affronted and disgusted by the fact that he has betrayed what his promises were and gone ahead with deeply involving the U.S. in foreign nations.
Well, we've already seen public denunciations of Trump by some of his far right, almost libertarian leading opponents. Alex Jones, this conspiracy theorist, a number of other talk show radio hosts were very critical of the bombing. Now, they don't represent much in the power structure of the Republican Party, but it is significant that they were the kind of people who brought a sector of people that didn't before vote for Trump into the Trump fold. And hopefully what will happen is those people will get alienated and come to see Trump for what he really is.
Well, one final question for you then. Assuming that Trump is able to keep his finger off the button, so to speak, how is this perceived? And how long will the initial outrage perception of this last, do you think? How will this be played? I mean, many people...
Remember, at the beginning of all of these crises, whether it was Clinton sending missiles into Afghanistan and Sudan, which was quickly forgotten, or the beginning of the Iraq War, people in the U.S. tend to rally around their president. And he's acting tough, he's defending our interests, he's standing up to the evil Assad. So there's going to be a certain amount of bump in popular support. I don't even think he's going to get up to 50%, however. Maybe he gets from 35 to 40 or something like that. He's so unpopular. Let's not forget that. But let's say for the moment there's some popular support for what he's doing. As Americans die in Syria, which they will, and in Iraq, as trillions of dollars are spent on useless wars. I mean, we spent almost $100 million just on launching those 59 Tommy Hawk missiles. That's think of how many schools or healthcare clinics or other things that could be built with $100,000, and it's just gone in the course of a few hours.
Yeah.
And that's just the tip
of the fireworks, network. Just yeah. fireworks.
It's just the fireworks, let alone the cost of the troops and the transportation and et cetera, et cetera. So we're talking trillions of dollars, and as Americans come to see the consequences of these actions, they will turn against them, and they will rally against Trump. You heard it here, folks. You heard it here first.
Yeah, yeah. And in, I think maybe on that note, we should end. Thank you so much for that. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
That was KBOO's Chris Andre speaking with author Rhys Ehrlich.
So is there anything?
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will have showers throughout the day with a high of 59 and a low of 47, with a matching forecast out in Hood River. Today in history, in the year 837 CE, Halley's Comet made its closest approach to Earth at about 3.2 million miles. The quote of the day comes from Shakespeare, who remarked, quote, "When beggars die, there are no comets seen. The heavens themselves blaze forth the death of princes."
It's just about 5:21. Time for Daily Commentary with Jim Hightower.
Why? That's the big question the mass media is asking about the sudden failure of the Republican leader's relentless push to demonize and kill Obamacare. After all, the GOP bragged that they now control the legislative game and would quickly knock Obama's trademark reform out of the park. And their star slugger was on deck, Donnie Trump, the self-proclaimed dealmaker extraordinaire. He assured his fawning political cronies that selling his repeal and replace plan to Congress was no different than selling memberships in his luxury golf resorts. It's the same thing, he insisted. Really, it is. So why did he fail? Most media speculation has focused on the real estate mogul's inability to grasp the nuances of legislating. True, but the fundamental cause of the embarrassing public collapse of the Trump Care Plan was not about process, but substance. As a master huckster, Trump could probably sell BS to a feedlot. But this bill was far more repugnant than the stinkiest load of BS. It gutted health care coverage for millions, while also sneaking in nearly a $1 trillion tax cut for huge corporations and Wall Street speculators. Even some Republican lawmakers gagged on the stench. But the real story is that the American people themselves, including many working-class voters who had believed Trump was actually going to help them, got a whiff of the nasty stuff he was peddling. Alerted by grassroots groups like Our Revolution and Indivisible, a mass rebellion erupted in the home districts of Republican Congress critters who were selling out the health of America's workaday majority. This is Jim Hightower saying, as the protests spread and dozens of GOP lawmakers washed their hands of his bill, Trump was exposed as a clueless dealmaker, repeatedly asking his staff, "Is this really a good bill? Is this really a good bill?"
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The political revolution that Senator Bernie Sanders envisioned and helped build as he ran for president lives on in Our Revolution. Former CWA President Larry Cohen heads an effort by Our Revolution to build a winning mass political movement around working class issues. Jobs and economic issues for sure, but also linked to other vital issues affecting working people.
They're all economic in some way, but we would link them together because that's, in this country, the only way you're going to build the kind of inclusive mass majority movement you need. We have to link them together always. I think there are obvious links, but we got to consciously be talking about racism, consciously talking about the devastation of climate change. But yeah, the core is jobs.
Cohen says to win support among working class voters, our revolution has to be rooted in issues that really matter to working people and make that obvious to working class voters no matter how they voted in the last election. Workers turned off by Hillary Clinton in November who voted Trump often said at town hall meetings that they liked Bernie Sanders. Cohen says that underscores the need to organize around strong worker issues and never back off those issues, even in more conservative small towns and rural areas.
That's why we're trying to be in the 3,000 counties, not just in the 500 that Clinton won, and that where Democrats tend to do well in this country, but to be in those small industrial towns like in Iowa, the Bettendorfs and the Waterloos, and also in rural Iowa, rural Wisconsin. I think you have to organize everywhere, not just where we're immediately popular.
Workers at Nestle Logistics and Distribution Center in Georgia will be represented by the RWDSU after a union election. The workers at the McDonough, Georgia Shipping Center fought for several months to create a strong voice in the workplace. RWDSU will represent 102 workers at that facility. Edgar Fields, president of the Southeast Council, RWDSU, says neither union-busting efforts nor flood and gale force winds could deter these workers from defending their right to organize, and now it's our turn, he says, to fight for them. A group of Lawrence County, Pennsylvania corrections officers and cooks are voting Tuesday on whether or not to join the Teamsters. They'll vote by secret ballot in two shifts Tuesday morning and afternoon. The Pennsylvania Labor Relations Board is conducting the election. These workers had a union until mid-January when Construction and General Laborers Union Local 964 ended the representation. If the Lawrence County jail workers vote union on Tuesday, they will be represented by Teamsters Local 261. WIN is made possible in part by the OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Tensions continue to increase worldwide as the Trump administration rattles its sabers against numerous countries. In the Far East, a U.S. aircraft carrier-led strike group is sailing to Korea as a response to the latest North Korean missile tests. The move comes after top U.S. military officials admitted that they had presented President Trump with several options to deal with the North Korean president, including placing nuclear weapons in South Korea and assassinating the North Korean president. Last week, President Trump warned China, North Korea's largest ally, that China needed to take care of the North Korea problem or the United States would do it unilaterally. Trump made the statement to the Chinese president at the same time U.S. forces launched several dozen cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase. In response, it has been reported that China has moved 180,000 troops to the North Korean border. In Syria, Russia and Iran have issued a warning to the U.S. and its allies that the cruise missile attacks last week on the Syrian Air Force base crossed a red line and that Russia would respond with force at any future aggression. U.S. officials responded that Russia needed to distance itself from Syria and that the Trump administration would hold Russia responsible for any atrocities committed by Syria. The cruise missiles launched by U.S. forces were in response to a purported chemical weapon attack by Syrian government forces against civilians. That attack is being questioned by many respected journalists, including award-winning journalist Robert Perry, who wrote that his sources in the CIA told him they notified the White House that Syrian President Assad was likely not responsible for the chemical weapons attack. Despite that, Trump administration officials ordered the cruise missile attack and continue to say that removing Syrian President Bashar Assad is a top priority.
The Trump administration's new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission has vowed to repeal net neutrality and will instead ask internet providers to voluntarily agree to maintain an open internet. The new chairman, Ajit Pai, is a Republican who was named to the board of the FCC in 2012 by President Obama. Net neutrality is the principle that internet service providers treat all data on the internet the same, not discriminating or charging different by user, content, website, or application. The FCC officially passed the net neutrality law in 2015. The law was immediately challenged in court by the U.S. Telecom Association. Then in 2016, the law was upheld in the U.S. Court of Appeals. The law will now be subject to the wishes of the Republican-controlled Congress and the Trump administration. In related news, President Trump has approved a congressional resolution repealing the FCC's broadband privacy rule. Internet service providers will now legally be able to collect and sell internet users' private information, including browsing history, email addresses, birth dates, usernames, and a wide variety of other information created by using the internet. While consumer rights and the internet freedom advocates have fought for internet privacy rules, companies such as Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Netflix have fought the privacy laws for years, both through the court system and by lobbying elected officials.
A year ago, citizens of Myanmar, also referred to as Burma, saw their first civilian president take office in a government led by pro-democracy icon Aung San Suu Kyi. This major step toward a representative government came after more than half a century of brutal military rule. While for decades any talk of human rights was banned, the country is now seeing hundreds of civil society organizations mushroom. But human rights advocates say not everyone is benefiting from the new freedoms in the country, also known as Burma. FSRN's Lena Ogard reports.
In North Okalaba, a suburb of Yangon, people are gathering in a large tin shack. Music is blasting from two speakers. It's the theme song of Akaya, a local women's organization that works to promote equality and rights for women throughout Myanmar. Today, the organization is hosting a play that aims to shed light on sexual assault on minors. In the play, a young girl is raped by an ice cream salesman. The story is based on an attack that took place in the area a few years ago. Papa Nan Tui, program coordinator of the Awareness Theater, estimates that only about 1 in 3 rape cases are reported. And in half of these cases, the girl is under 16.
We believe the 3-in-1 survivors are reported to the police.
Nan Tui explains that in much of Myanmar, the social construct around rape and even domestic abuse does not view these assaults as violence. And most people, both men and women, don't consider sexual assault and domestic abuse violations of women's rights. She illustrated her point after the play by asking if anyone in the audience knew of cases of violence against women and girls.
Is there any violence in this village? She said no. The husband beat the wives? Yes. Oh, they don't know what is the violence. So.
For 50 years, while Myanmar was ruled by an oppressive military junta, any call for human rights could lead to years in prison. This started to change in 2011 when the military government introduced a series of reforms that enabled activists and civil society groups to form and work openly. Hundreds of new organizations sprung up. At the same time, restrictions on access to information were eased, and in less than 5 years, internet penetration has gone from less than 1% to 20%. A year ago, after a landslide electoral victory, the National League for Democracy, the so-called NLD, took office. Led by the internationally praised Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi, the victory was hailed as the official beginning of a new democratic era for Myanmar. In another Yangon suburb, LGBT rights activist Tin Ko Ko works at an office promoting awareness about HIV and AIDS. During the lead-up to the landmark election, Tin Ko Ko and his community campaigned to get the NLD elected. They expected that the new government would cancel some of Myanmar's repressive laws targeting the LGBT community. While they can now talk openly about homosexuality, they are still waiting for meaningful legislative reforms.
For us, it means we can work more freely and it's easier to cooperate with other organizations. But homosexuality is still not widely accepted, and even the new government and high-level officials say that many issues are more important than LGBT rights.
Officially, engaging in homosexual acts is illegal in Myanmar, according to an old law dating back to the British colonial times. It is rarely enforced, But according to Coco, police officers and authorities use it as an excuse to harass, blackmail, and abuse members of the LGBT community.
We hoped for and expected more rights with this new government. We worked actively to get them elected and voted for them ourselves. But we are not satisfied.
And 12 months later, activists like Coco are starting to wonder how long they must wait to see noteworthy changes in policies and laws. Techwai Win plays with his 4-year-old daughter. He has been a human rights activist since 2007 and was a staunch supporter of the NLD.
So, because we voted this government because we believe that they can bring the change for the country. We believe that they are the government of the people. But even like almost 1 year now, there's not really, tangible change that we can see yet. Many people have started, getting talked.
Echoing a number of international human rights organizations, Sui Win criticizes the government and especially Suu Kyi, locally referred to as the Lady, for continuing the oppression of minorities, especially the Muslim Rohingyas.
They don't really listen to the people. They said like they are war for people. But in reality, the Lady, she keep quiet for the issue of Rohingya.
In April, Myanmar will host a small by-election. Sui Win predicts another landslide victory for NLD, mainly because there is no real opposition. He fears the party's huge support will make them even more reluctant to move forward with democratic reforms, and that Myanmar's new democracy is not truly a democracy for all its people. Lina Otgor for FSRN in Yangon, Myanmar.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenna Yokoyama and Zelos Marchant. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Mike Fataklis. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tracy Kiyama.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Then at 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener comments. And at 9 on Alternative Radio, Jeffrey Stone says, "How much we value the right of free speech is to put to its severest test when the speaker is someone we disagree with the most." He speaks on the fight for free speech on college campuses. At 10 a.m., Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. Then at 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Stage and Studio, DMA Roberts welcomes back New York Times bestselling author Lisa C. in her new book, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane. And at 11:30, Art Focus welcomes the director of Portland Design Week, running from April 21st to the 29th. Plus, he looks at Untitled Studios' concept for the Portland Green Loop. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
If you're listening to our broadcast earlier, you heard how today is National Siblings Day. National Siblings Day was created in 1995 by Claudia Everett as a way to honor her siblings. Everett has compared the day to Mother's Day or Father's Day, hoping that people would take the day to spend time with or acknowledge their siblings. So for today's News in Depth, we have a special guest here to talk about their firsthand experience as a sibling. Welcome to Tracy Kiyama, my older sister.
Thanks for having me, Jenna, my sibling.
Thanks for anchoring the news today for Sibling Day.
It was very exciting.
Yeah, that was pretty good for a first time. I'll give
thanks,
it to you there.
Thanks.
So, you know, we're just sort of here to have a kind of informal conversation about what it is to be siblings, I guess, in America today. I will say that my sister is, I like to always emphasize, she's my older sister, although she looks younger than me, according to most people we meet.
Most people think we're the same age, that we're friends.
It's true, although a lot of people say that we look like each other, but we don't think we look like each other.
Yeah, either people think we're friends or they think like we're twins.
Yeah, that's really weird. I can't figure out how that one works. I guess everybody really sees what they want to see.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll just kind of start. We'll start at the beginning.
Okay.
We'll start at the beginning. So we're 3.5 years apart.
Right.
Do you remember when I came into the world, when you stopped being Tracy, only child queen of the world?
No, I have no memory of that at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I just remember by the time you were about one and when I wanted to throw you away, that's when I start remembering you. So maybe you were like 6 months old when I started, or at least my memory is, you're in my memories. Yes.
And do you remember that being a positive feeling or?
No, it's a very negative feeling. I really did not like the fact that you were alive. And so I wanted to throw you away. I still have a scar from the time I tried to kill you by folding you in the stroller.
I do remember that. That's one of my first memories in life. I don't even know how old I was, but I know I was quite small because I was in a stroller.
Yeah.
And all I remember is the pain of having my arm stuck in one of the joints of the stroller being closed. And that's possibly my earliest memory in life is my sister hating me. By trying to pull me into a stroller.
Well, I still have a scar from it, if it makes you feel any
better. Wait, how do you have a scar from this?
I don't know. Somehow my ankle, like the skin on my ankle got stuck in the joint of the stroller. Because this was like the 80s, and so the stroller was very, you know, like unsafe. And so my skin got caught in the joint, and it gave me like a scratch on my ankle. I mean, it's more than a scratch because I still have this scar, like, you know, 30 however many years later. And and so I still have a scar.
Can I admit that makes me like happy because I never knew about the scar part all these years later. I never knew about the scar part. And I've always thought it was kind of a funny, but like also slightly bitter story of like, who closes their sibling in a stroller? Like, oh my gosh. And so to hear that you actually have a scar that I don't think I even have a scar, but you are the one with the scar, just
scar.
To constantly remind you of the thing that you did.
Yes.
Okay. I feel a little less bitter about that story now.
Well, I'm glad my attempts did not work because I'm very happy to have you as a sibling.
Well, what did you think was going to happen? Well, we won't even get to what you thought was going to happen.
And then one time I left you in the garage in your stroller, and I think I was supposed to stay with you until mom could come back and get you, but I just went inside the house, and I think I hoped something bad was going to happen while I wasn't
there. Oh, yeah. I remember this as well. This happened near the time of being closed in the stroller.
Yeah, it was around the same time.
Yeah, because I remember being really scared. I wasn't going to go anywhere because the garage door was closed, so it wasn't like anyone's going to kidnap me, but I just remember being in the dark and being really mad at you. So in my memory, you've always done this thing on purpose, but I guess, that was you. Our nickname for you as a child, or as we've looked back on you actually, is we've come up with the nickname Dictator Tracy.
You say our, like I had something to do with it, but I think it's
When I say our, I'm referring to me and my friends growing up who I was like, oh gosh, Dictator Tracy did this. And like, oh goodness, your sister.
Yeah,
so you weren't too happy to have a sibling.
No, but I think around, I don't know, once you got a little older, like when you were 3 or 4 and you could actually do stuff with me, then I thought, okay, well, this is kind of fun. I can always have a friend to play with. or boss around.
Yes, I was about to say. It felt at the time more like now I have someone to constantly boss around. But you know what's funny? As sibling, as a younger sibling, because you were always this bossy person, I never knew you to be any other way.
Right.
And I didn't, you know, and I was small. And so I didn't think of you as being very mean or being very bossy until other people pointed out that, like, do you know that your sibling is bossy and she could allow you to do more things? Like, all the toys aren't necessarily hers. She doesn't have to make up all the rules. And I don't remember what age I was. Maybe I was almost like in first or second grade and realizing this and then feeling extremely ripped off. Like, oh my goodness, no one told me that I got to have opinions too.
Sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. Because I always, even though I thought you were a bossy, like, older sister when we were little, for sure, mm-hmm. I definitely feel like you were also really nice to me. You weren't just, like, mean and controlling. You were really nice to me at the same time, too. And I feel
that's
like
good.
We laughed and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, we did have a lot of fun.
You were a benevolent dictator,
exactly.
Tracy.
Exactly. I let you have food.
And then you got nice. You got really nice to me as a sibling when you were like in like fourth grade.
In fourth grade, when friends at school pointed out how mean I was when we moved to the new school.
Oh yeah, we changed cities.
Right. And then I realized that if I wanted to have friends that I needed to stop being so mean and bossy. And so then I started to become nice, which extended to being nice to you.
I really like those people at school who told you that. But, you know, and when I think about us as siblings, we, you know, we really got along. And that was something I thought as a child, at least. And even when I was a teenager, I thought this was like a very inherent thing that all siblings got along. Because even when I went over to other people's houses, I saw that, oh, people just basically got along. But I didn't realize until we were older that we were actually friends as well as siblings who got along.
Right.
And that was actually not as common as I thought. Have you had that same experience kind of in talking to other people about their siblings?
Yeah, I think I noticed that in high school, actually, because I would do things for you, like drive you and your friends around. Mm-hmm. Like, remember we went toilet papering somebody's house and I agreed to, like, go buy you toilet paper or, you know, things like that. And I would tell my friends about what we did. They would say, gosh, why are you so nice to your sister?
Yeah. People would always say that. I would, like, all my friends would be like, wow, your sister is the nicest sibling, because we could never get anybody else to drive us around. And I will say, after you did the toilet papering thing, you officially went in the book as everybody's favorite cooler older sister.
Yes.
Like, all my friends wanted to